New today or haven't been here for a while, we've been going through a series called Talk Back, and I'd just like to tell you a little bit about that series. We've aimed to talk about things that we think about but don't talk about, and for a change, not talk about things that we don't think about. Does that make sense?
Can you say that?
Yeah, right? Often we talk about things that we don't often think about. And we think about things that we don't talk about. So we're going to talk about things that we think about but don't talk about. That's the Talk Back series. The applause mystifies me, but I'll take it. And today we are going to be talking about mental illness. And I for sure don't make myself out to be an expert on this, but we have two guests who have, I think, some expertise to offer us in this. And we want to actually just take these things that we haven't talked about much and break the silence and start talking. And a lot of you, if you have a desire to ask a question of myself or the panel, you'll be given an opportunity. So I'm just giving you fair warning that if you think you might want to ask a question, be prepared that you will be given a chance later on. You know, I've been told by family and others that I sometimes go through phases. Like, phases like I've had a bread phase where I like to make a lot of bread. Still in that a little bit. A hockey phase where I played tons and tons of hockey. I kind of get focused on things and can't stop doing them. Once, believe it or not, I had a bonsai tree phase. I had a bonsai tree phase, and I loved these little trees that looked so wizened and old, and they reminded me of the windswept trees on the BC coast, you know, that you see up on the hills. And so I started buying bonsai trees. I don't think I had a lot, maybe two, and they were quite small, but I started reading books on bonsai and how to do it, and I even had a little rake. It was about this long for raking the leaves up and collecting the leaves and making sure that there were no dead leaves there. And what I learned about bonsai was that you have to nurture them. You take them out of the pot and you trim the roots so that they stay dwarfed, because you're trying to dwarf the trees. And you can shape them into different shapes that look natural, like a landscape thing. And I really liked doing that. But one of the things about these bonsais that I realized that it was just that I wasn't patient enough. I realized that I should have bought a 100-year-old bonsai instead of trying to make them. And you know where my bonsai trees now are now? They're all dead. They're all dead. And I learned from bonsai tree making or growing or whatever it was that it takes time. A lot and a lot of time. And I think we're going to learn today that love is like those bonsais. We can like the idea. We can research it. We can study it. We can read about it. We can buy the tools and work at it. But it takes time. It takes a lot of time. There's this passage in one of the letters to the Corinthians, the church in Corinth, from the Apostle Paul. And there's this particular part where he talks about what love is like. We heard it this morning. And I think people like this verse. I know they like it. Because I get requests all the time for weddings. Oh, why don't we do that love verse? You know that one? Can we read that at our wedding? The one that has pictures of angels beside it usually. Love is patient. I see it on posters. I see it in artwork. And I see it on the walls of people's houses when I come in. We actually have one of those too, so I'm not picking on you. We have one of those artsy love things on our wall. But I think the risk is it's so familiar to us when we read it, when we hear it, we hear all the good intentions and fuzzy edges of a family postcard. It just becomes so soft. And today I want to challenge you to try and hear it afresh. Well, take a listen and I'm sure you will recognize it. This is 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 4 to 7. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. There's a lot more about love in there, but I'm going to stop there. You getting it about love? That it sounds nice? Sounds like a good thing, right? This is what love is like. Loving like this and learning how takes time. I know we like the idea of love, of this kind of love, in a marriage, maybe even in a family, or maybe if you've been married for a while and you take a trip to Montreal, you like the idea of this kind of love. Yes, you know who I'm talking to. He's not talking about, this is the thing though, he's not talking about friends who get together for barbecues and celebrate their friendship and the friendship that's just so easy. Not even about families who are motivated by blood and loyalty and tradition to love like this. No, you know who he's talking to? He's talking to a bunch of strangers that God called together to this thing he called the church. A bunch of people with different abilities, interests, and personalities. Easygoing people, abrasive people, healthy people, sick people, big people, small people, young people, old people, men, women, children. All of them, people who don't normally belong together. And that's the point. And he's saying, all of these people, these ones I have gathered, they all belong. They're not just included, they belong. What does belonging mean for us in the church when it comes to mental illness? And I want you to know that when it comes to mental illness, I am talking to all of us. I'm talking to all of us. All of us will be touched by this in some way, whether directly or indirectly. It will affect us. So, what am I talking about? I'm sure a guest can clarify this if this is a bit off, but mental illness is a behavioral pattern or a thinking pattern that causes significant distress in someone's life or impairment in personal functioning. And I'm aware that some of the obstacles and stigmas around this are prevalent in the life of the church. You know, when someone has the flu, we don't say, hey, they are flu. We don't say that. Hey, look at that person, they're flu. But when someone has depression, we say they are depressed. Maybe semantics? But a significant reveal about how we see it, I think. We in our society tend to define the whole person based on that illness. And that definition can lead to intolerance, rejection, and lack of belonging. Now, it wasn't that long ago, and it probably still persists in some circles, that among Christians, they didn't believe in depression or anxiety. I don't know if that's familiar to any of you, but if you were a person suffering from either of these, you were told that you didn't understand the gospel message or hadn't accepted it, or there was something wrong with your faith. It's a very familiar message in Christian circles. And this is something else I know, that it can be a long, silent, lonely, private journey. And we want to break that today. Statistics tell us that 1 in 4 people will experience mental illness in their lifetime. And that actually is based on people that have actually gone to see a GP or a practitioner and been officially diagnosed. Worldwide, 1 in 3 report sufficient criteria for at least some kind of diagnosis in their lifetime. And in the USA, it's almost 50% at some point in their life. Anxiety disorders are the most common, with depression followed by mood disorders and substance disorders. So I'm talking to you. I'm talking to all of us. If you suffer from mental illness, I'm talking to you. If you don't, I'm talking to you. Because only together are we going to display the kind of love we see described in 1 Corinthians 13. And if you are one of those many people who suffer directly with mental illness, God calls us not in spite of our struggles with mental illness, but because of them. And if you're one of the other people that doesn't suffer directly, God calls us not because we are perfect, but because we are flawed. And God calls us together because when we live in love, we express to the world what God is like. So with mental illness, what is our call? What does love look like? Is it acceptance? Is it tolerance? Is it understanding? What does love mean to and from those who may be or may have yet to be suffering from mental illness? You know that nice little list in 1 Corinthians 13? That wedding list? That's the one we are called to live in. And I'm not talking about this as a wedding vow, as an ideal relationship, as a cozy idea. Did you know that the verses that we looked at today are not primarily descriptive, but prescriptive? That makes a big difference. The bad news is, it's not saying, oh, now you're a Christian, you've got this. You love like that. And that's kind of the good news too. I'll bracket that one. No, it's saying, oh, now you're a Christian. By the grace of God and the empowerment of the Holy Spirit, this is what it means now to love. When we don't want to love, when it's easier to walk away, that's when this passage takes effect. When we take a hit because someone is hurting or fearful or they do something mean, that's when this passage takes effect. When we want to exclude and push people out to the margins, that's when this passage takes effect. Growing into love is a long, hard road. Patience, kindness, perseverance, forgiveness, hope, humility, giving, protecting, hoping, persevering, trusting. They all take time. They take time to develop. They take time to grow. You know how this love is cultivated? It's cultivated in the messy places of life. The places of life that rarely have a pretty 1 Corinthians 13 poster up with nice, cozy words about love and acceptance. No, it's more like the gardens that have a lot of mess in them. And we call that mess manure. Situations that have a lot of manure in them. Situations of life that are described by presence of manure. That's fertile ground. And that's the place that God causes his plants to grow. The places where there is mess, where there is struggle, these are places that are fertile. These places grow us into that plant that makes us more like Jesus. And I want to tell you guys, if you think you have to go somewhere else to find that mess, You need to find a different church or different people. You're mistaken. That mess is all around us. It's everywhere. It's right in front of us. It's in all those places of life that we keep silent and secret because we don't want people to see them. We don't want to tell people about them. You know, it's easy to tell people that you're going to have a great garden, that you're going to grow this magnificent masterpiece, and it's easy to tell people that you have a great plan for a garden, that you anticipate it will grow many, many nice things. And you can tell people all you want, but really you're just telling them about a garden. We can tell people about the church. We can tell people about Jesus. We can tell people about love. But really, until it's seen, until it's demonstrated, until it's felt, it doesn't demonstrate this love. Only when the church can be seen to be the church can people be persuaded that this is indeed the church. The love of Jesus, the love that is being described here, can't just be talked about. It needs to be seen to believed, touched, felt, experienced. You need to actually put your hands in the dirt. The beginning point of the church's ministry alongside people with mental illness is the recognition and cultivation of that love. And so this wonderful, amazing, descriptive prescription of love in 1 Corinthians 13 is calling us to move beyond inclusion to belonging. And the problem with inclusion is obvious. There is no belonging, no community, no cohesion in love, no give and take, where those who are perceived to be different are simply included. It might be a good step. But we need to move beyond inclusion to belonging. Beyond you can come along. Beyond we can put up with you. Beyond you can join to belonging. To belong, you need to be missed when you're not present. To belong, others need to long for you. To belong, we need to feel that we matter. To belong means that you are loved. And when we realize that the church cannot truly be the church without each person feeling that they belong, we will be living the description and the prescription of 1 Corinthians 13. And when it comes to mental illness, belonging is the enemy of the stigma. Belonging destroys loneliness and fear. Belonging is the heart of the gospel. Belonging pushes us to alter our hearts and change our minds in ways that enable the creation of new spaces of relating. Places where we are all missed when we are not there. And I don't know if this sounds overwhelming to you. I could see that. But we're really just talking about small things here. Little things, tiny things. There's power in small things. The calling of the church is not necessarily to be cutting edge and edgy or technical and technique driven. The calling of the church is to be wise and faithful to small things that God calls us to. We don't have to change the world. God changes that. We just have to signal the kingdom through small things. Sharing a meal. Telling someone they belong by journeying with them. Walking with someone, listening to someone. Not running away when someone expresses an emotion that you don't like. These are small things that make a big difference. And there's power in them. You know that bonsai thing I went through? It was all about small things. And what I wanted to do was big things. I wanted to do it all in one day. I wanted to shave that tree clean. I wanted to prune it. I wanted to get it shaped exactly the way I wanted it. But a bonsai is all about small things, small changes, and it takes time. A little here, a little there, not too much. No rush. Small prunings. Love takes time to grow, and it grows in the fertile places of life. And you know that description of love in 1 Corinthians 13? The description is the prescription. When we nurture the small things, amazing things grow. Do you know what time it is, FBC? It's time for talk back. Come on up. Get right there, babe. Awesome. Like to welcome our guest today. We have Melissa Hallman and Gary White. And I'm just going to grab this. And just in case you didn't know, they are a father-daughter team up here today, which makes this pretty cool. Yes, I can see where you got your looks from, Gary. Oh, I'm sorry, I got that backwards. Is that your favorite joke? So I would wonder if you could tell us a bit about your experience with mental illness, and either one of you can go first.
Can you go first? Since a lot of my experience is linked to your experience.
let's see now. I was first diagnosed with depression probably close to 20 years ago. It was fairly minimal, so I was on a very minimal dose of antidepressant. And then about 6 years ago, it became much worse. So I went from minimal to severe, and actually ended up in hospital, in the McNair, or the psych ward at the hospital. And then from that point on, I range in the middle to moving up the scale, but not to the point of where I was when I was hospitalized. So.
Thank you.
And for me, I am a social worker. I'm working in the adolescent psychiatry unit, but for the last 6 years, I have focused, and you can see how we're linked. In the last 6 years, I've focused my career on mental health and the treatment of mental health. And I think initially when Kevin asked for me to be part of this panel, I was a little hesitant because I'm not a person that is living with mental illness. And as a social worker, often we want to amplify the voices of the people that are. And so I'm not a person that has had thoughts of killing myself. I'm not a person that has experienced voices of things that are not there. And so I wanted to be cautious about that. And I think that sometimes we have the tendency to think, because I experienced exam once at anxiety during my exam time, during my master's degree, that I understand what it's like to live with anxiety. And I think that it can inform our empathy, but it is not the same as living with it. But in talking with my dad, so why am I actually on the stage with all those concerns? In talking with my dad, he had such an interesting point that I have walked with him. And so I'm coming from a perspective of having walked with many people, but a perspective of being a family member.
Thank you for being up here, by the way. I think it takes a lot of courage And I think just by being up here and talking about it, you are breaking something for people. And we're breaking the silence. And I think that's very helpful. So both of you can answer this next question if you like. But my question is, do you think the church has been a safe place for people that are struggling with mental illness?
I think we have to sort of differentiate between First Baptist Church and the church. Because over the centuries, the church has not done a very good job. I think they look back in Scripture at the story of the demoniac who is, Jesus casts the demon spirit out into the pigs and they go off over the cliff into the water. And so for the church, it became, mental illness became very much a demonic type of thing. And so mental illness in many ways was demonized. And I think for quite a while it was like that. But over a period of time, I think the church has become more and more aware that when we talk about mental illness, we're talking about an issue with the brain in the same way we would talk about a broken leg being an issue there. And so for me, when I talk about First Baptist Church, I feel very safe. I'm like Troy when he spoke last week and talked about the church being safe. Now, I am very open about the disease, but all I've ever felt here is loved by people. So would I say this is a safe place? I would, yes.
I think that mental illness for a lot of people, or maybe I should say mental health for a lot of people, right? Because I think that there's a spectrum of health. I think that our society has really pegged people that are struggling with mental health as a problem of motivation, right? Like that people just can't get themselves together. And I think that in the church, we take it a step further. From motivational failing to a moral failing. Maybe you're not praying hard enough. Maybe you're not close enough to God. Or we look at treatment for a mental illness and shame that in a way of maybe we're just not trying hard enough, or you know, maybe you need to pray harder. And I think the example of a broken leg is so good. And the other example I often go to is the example of diabetes. Like, we don't often tell people that have to take insulin that they just aren't praying hard enough.
I talked about the church being very safe for me, but there are many more people within this congregation who suffer from mental illness that you don't know about. And so I'm not sure that I can't speak on their behalf as to whether or not First Baptist Church is a safe place for them. And part maybe of why I feel safe is because I have shared the fact that I do suffer. And our congregation is a very loving place where people surround me, and I know they're praying for me. So for me, it is a safe place.
So this next question, you don't have to answer necessarily in terms of First Baptist Church, but I'm wondering if you can tell us what role the church has to play in helping or harming people with mental illness.
One of the things we have to realize, I think, is that mental illness has in many ways changed in, Melissa, the last 25 or 30 years, maybe. For a long time in history, people with mental illness were put away in a place. And their treatment occurred within that insane asylum, whatever you want to call it. It was a hospital. Now, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, more treatment occurs within the community than people would be put in some form of institution. So therefore, we are seeing much more mental illness in our day-to-day lives, be it in our community or be it in our church or school or our workplace. And because of that, we're all of a sudden having to deal with things that we never had to deal with before. It's like our church. Our church used to be in the suburbs, and it was clean, and there was no problems. But now we're an inner city church, and so we deal with things we never dealt with before. It is the same thing with mental illness. We are dealing with things that we never had to deal with before, and so therefore it has changed how we have to see our church on a day-to-day basis. And what 1 Corinthians.
So yes, treatment of mental illness or mental health is mostly happening now in communities. People are not hospitalized unless they're really a safety concern or if their medication just really needs to be looked at and they need to be in the care of a care team to do that. But I think to go back to what you were saying about prevalence, I was looking at Statistics Canada last night, and they report from the 2012 was this report, but they say 1 in 3 Canadians over the course of their lifetime will experience some form of mental illness. And that was based on, I think it was based on a census, and the census only identified 6 mental health, like mental illness categories. And so I think what I can tell you is, first of all, there's way more than 6 mental health categories, and that relies on people's self-report. And so when we look at statistics, we always need to be careful, and we always need to question, is there flaws, and what are the flaws? And so first of all, I would say the prevalence of mental illness is bigger than 1 in 3. And so the odds of one of us experiencing mental illness is high, but the odds of us knowing and loving somebody that's experiencing mental illness is even higher. It's going to happen to everybody, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that we've kind of spoken already to how churches have historically maybe not been safe places. But I think that one of the ways that churches have historically and still historically help people that are struggling with mental health issues is that we are a community, right? And we come together and we love and support and connect with each other. And so I think that isolation is one of a big factor for people who are struggling, right?
Yeah. Thank you. So if you could maybe describe to us what do you think love looks like practically in extending that towards a community or people with mental illness, what would that look like practically?
What I see as far as practicality within this congregation are the amazing, loving people here who will come up to me on a Sunday morning and say, "How are you doing?" And it's not a, "How are you doing? I'll just keep on walking by and going." It is, "How are you doing? I really want to know what's going on in your life." And when the depression is bad, there really isn't anything that you can say other than that is going to change. Telling me that, you know what, you're not a failure, because my brain is telling me that. My brain is telling me I'm a failure, I've dropped the ball, I'm a disaster. I don't deserve the people who love me to love me, and on and on. Saying that those aren't true to me probably is not going to help at the time. But what really does help is when you say, I'll pray for you. I'm going to be praying for you. I will be praying for you on an ongoing basis. Because in the darkness of depression, I can honestly say, I can tell when people are praying for me. It breaks through into that really deep, dark place that depression is. part of depression, and for many of you, there's probably a sense that this is just sadness. Well, it's beyond sadness. It's to a point of hopelessness. And that's why for some, the hopelessness gets to be too much and they end up committing suicide. And it's into that hopelessness that prayers really work in an amazing way. It's into that place that God intervenes and he says, you know, there's more for you. I still love you. And no matter where you are, what you're doing, I still love you and I still care for you. And you're still my son. And you begin to build then this sort of debit and credit thing of the things that are bad in your life. And then you look at all the amazing things that God has blessed you with. And you try to pull yourself up from that place. But quite honestly, I can tell you that praying for people that you know suffer from mental illness is the best thing you can possibly do.
I think sometimes when people are experiencing something that's different than what our experience is, we have this propensity to move away from. Because we're the society of fixers, right? So if I can't fix you, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to respond. I don't know how, you know, I can't say something that's going to fix you. So we don't say anything. And I think that with a lot of things in life, people don't need us to fix them. They need us to listen with the intent to understand. They need us to believe that what they're saying is true. They need us to be able to notice when something's up, and be able to just come alongside, right? And I think that empathy is the ability to sit with people and struggle. And I think that that's a big thing, right? And I think if we're not experiencing mental illness ourselves, it's really hard to understand the nuance, right? Like when you're talking about people thinking that mental illness is just sadness or depression is just sadness, depression has all these biological components that you're not experiencing otherwise. Like there's lots of people that report issues with their balance when they're dealing with depression, that they have issues with reaction time, memory, that the taste of food is different or lacking in dealing with depression. And so I think, you know, that stuff we can't understand, but there's a lot of what we can do is around, it's accepting people into our community, right? And I think that that's a desire of everybody to be able to belong.
So if you could tell us one thing that you'd like us to learn about this or do differently about mental illness, what would it be?
I think that we need to expand our picture of what church is. That it's not just Sunday mornings, but this is about living life together in a community. We live in this world that is more and more obsessed with technology and obsessed with, like, how many friends do I have on Facebook or followers on Instagram? And we believe that that is connection. And I think that as a church, we have this amazing opportunity to provide true connection for people. And we all need that.
I would say for me, it's what you did this morning. Because it is one of the things that we don't talk about. It's something we acknowledge is there because many of us have been touched by it. But the fact that you decided to do this morning is, I think, very key. And in many of the subjects that we've dealt with in the last few weeks, that we begin this dialogue and we begin to admit that these things exist, that people are dealing with some difficult things within our congregation. And to tie it to 1 Corinthians 13, I thought was just a really awesome tie. the more we talk about it, the more people will be feel at ease to be able to talk about it within their lives, and then be able to ask people if they would pray for them, that they would keep them in their prayers, and that they would be there to give them a hug on days when it's just not a good time. But I really thank you for doing this, because this is huge.
Thank you. So I would like to give you a chance to ask some questions, and I actually need to have someone who is willing and able to run around with the mic and bring it to people. You have a volunteer for that? Dale Numata, come on down. Thank you, Dale. Just raise your hand if you have a question. Thanks, Penny.
I don't really have a question. I just have a comment. I live with someone who has depression. And, you know, you all know Peter. And, it's tough living with someone with depression who doesn't come to church, because they don't really know the impact that God, having God in their life, can do for them. Because God helps you through everything, right? And he's there for you, and he loves you unconditionally. And when you live with someone who doesn't go to church, lives with depression, then it's a little bit harder, because they don't always believe that God's going to help them through everything, because they have the depression, and it doesn't, it doesn't help them. They feel that God's not helping them because they don't have the belief that God will help them. And I try to tell Peter that, and I also pray for him all the time and help. And in the beginning of our relationship, when I was learning about depression, because I didn't know anything, because I'd never had it myself, because I'm always a happy person most of the time, as you know. And so I've had to learn over the years how to live with it and how to support him. And there are some days when I used to, in the early stages when I was learning about it, I would come home and I would be worried about coming home sorry to put it in this term, but in a pool of blood or something, because he tried to do something to himself. Because he's had those thoughts a lot, and he does get them, and he's been to the psych ward, as you have, three times since we've been together. But he says that he has told me that having him in my life, or having me in his life, has been good for him, because I'm a happy person, and that I help him, and I help him through it. So I just wanted to say that there is hope, and help, and just being there for the person, and just telling them that he may not come to church, but he does believe, and he does believe in prayer, and he likes it when the church prays for him, because I tell him, and he likes that, and he's been a much better person since he's been with me. So I just wanted to say that.
Thanks, Penny.
First of all, let me tell you what an amazing lady you are. And I believe that the input that you have into Peter's life is incredibly important. Because I think the first line of working with depression is with spouses and is with family members. And the lady sitting back there is my rock. And today we're celebrating our 40th wedding anniversary. And when she spoke her vows and said, for better or worse, she meant it. And so she is this amazing, loving rock in my life that I could not do without. And my kids are my other rock. They are these amazing people who were there for me as well. And I have my three little antidepressant granddaughters that infuse energy and life into me on an ongoing basis. That is so amazingly key as well. So, Penny, you are a tremendous blessing to Peter, and don't forget it, okay?
Tina.
By the way, congratulations. I remember the day you were married. We were busy planting our garden, and we had to stop in the middle of it to go to your wedding. Anyway, this may be a little bit off the topic, but Gregory has a brain injury. He's not depressed by any means, and there's a difference between a mental illness and a brain injury, which a lot of people don't realize. So it's 27 years since he had his brain hemorrhage, and he's had a couple of bleeds, they call, since then. So people can see that he is physically, you know, challenged, obviously. He's in Cottonwood right now. But the brain injury, he didn't always tell those silly jokes. A lot of people weren't here 27 years ago. Gary, you knew him, and he didn't have those silly jokes in those days, but that is part of the brain injury. It's really not a mental illness, but it still affects the brain. So there is a difference. Just thought people might like to know. Thanks.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
Joe. I found it interesting, Melissa, that you were able to describe those physical symptoms so well. And Gary, you described the mental journey really well. The emotional one seems to be a combination of those two. But the one that I'm sitting here wrestling with is the spiritual dimension. You mentioned it with prayer, but I was wondering if we also see those symptoms with the spiritual aspect of our being.
In seeing, Joe, I just want to make sure I get what you're saying, that the words that are being spoken to me in my brain, that there is a spiritual component to those?
I don't know. That's what I don't know.
Okay. Everybody I've ever talked to who suffers from depression will always tell you the same story as to what their brain tells them. It is across the board that the brain will tell you that you are useless, that you've dropped the ball, that you're a failure. And it is nonstop, ongoing when the depression is at its worst. There is a spiritual component to that because you're in this dark, lonely place and your brain is telling you something over and over and over again that you have a choice to buy into, or you have a choice to say it's not true. And so from the spiritual side of that, does Satan use that to attack you? Yeah, I think he does, because he always attacks us when we're at our weakest place. It is just how he operates. And so he will constantly try and get us in that place. The thing that when I said that when people pray for you, it begins to break that loop. Part of it is because it pushes you into a position of coming to terms with what the lies really are. And Melissa can probably speak more to the actual process of going through and cutting the loop of those words, where you actually stop them in the midst of that cycle of it coming around and around and around and telling you that you're this terrible person. When that gets cut, then you can get to the point in your life of recognizing that you are lovable, that God does love you and God does care for you, and that you are worthy of being loved. But you have to be able to cut that. If you don't cut it, you keep on falling into the rhythm of believing what your brain is telling you, because it's your brain. You know? It's been telling you stuff all your life that it's supposedly okay, so. I hope that.
Be answered fairly quickly because our kids are still in care, okay?
I just want to add that I think that for some people that are dealing with mental health issues, that they, like you're saying, lose the ability to trust their bodies, and I think lose the ability to trust the messaging, right? And so then there's starting to be a question of, is this from God or is this not? And so I think that that's a piece that I think is complicated.
Troy.
Pretty simple question. I call it the caveman syndrome. When it's really dark, you go into the cave and you just want to hide. I want to know how, I admit it, professionally trained fixer, right? How do I practically come into that cave without just grabbing you by the hair and yanking you out? My best friend's bald, so I can't do it with him. I have to grab him by the foot. He lets me, though. So, you know, if you can, just how do I, when I say I say how do we come into that cave in that way that draws you back out?
I don't think you pull people out of the cave. You go and sit in the cave with them and you say, what is this like for you? Brené Brown has a really good kind of snippet cartoon about empathy. It is well worth a watch, right? It's about climbing into the hole with somebody and trying to let them talk about it.
Yeah. Okay, so last question. We will be available after if you still have questions, okay? But this is the last public question. Marlene.
Gary, you talked a lot about what people can do individually, one-to-one. I'm wondering about the possibility of our church having some kind of mood disorder or depression support group, whether it's within the church or whether we get people. I was in one a long time ago when I moved to Edmonton, and it was the middle of winter, and it was dark, and my RA wasn't... was not well treated, and I found it did help me. It was the only, I didn't know anybody, so it was the only time I really got out. I mean, you do have to push yourself to do that, but I was wondering, is that a possibility? Do you think it would help? Kevin, is that even an option? You know, is it, you know, if it's a possibility?
I think that nobody understands depression like people who have depression or any other mental illness, I'm sure. That when you can sit together with people and talk and know they understand the place that you are at or where you have been or what you feel like you're going towards is huge. The only thing I would suggest is that there be some people with education in that area that would help to facilitate that. That would be hugely important as well. But I completely agree, Marnie. I think that's a really good idea.
So there was a question for me in that too. And I'm going to tread lightly and cautiously because I really don't know much about this. I'm a strong believer in togetherness. And so because I'm learning from you guys about the value of being together with people of similar mind, that's something I think I hear you saying and that we should look at. I also believe in journeying with diversity as well. So it sounds like it's something that we need to do maybe both of, and I think we should look at that. So thank you. So thank you very much for coming up and being courageous.